Now, first of all, instead of foundations of mindfulness, which was in the old version, we call them focuses of mindfulness. Because we all know what mindfulness is, and we should right now, otherwise Angie's not doing her job. But it's the focus where we put mindfulness. So take the four foundations of mindfulness, either one direction only, purification of beings, going beyond sadness and crying instead of lamentation. Hardly anybody knows what lamentation means, but crying, you know what that means. Disputes of physical and mental suffering, tending to a realization of divine, one of the four. And just why not use numbers? 1, 2, 3, 4. That's what we're used to. And always having restrained the five hindrances. So we can learn enough to do this practice. You abide aware of the body. Now instead of saying the bhikkhu, the monk or he, you say you abide aware of the body, energize, know the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. And the other thing which I forgot to mention yesterday, that in some translations it says mindful of the body in the body. And that is just a very bad translation. It's a peculiarity of the Pali language. They have like the verb, you do body awareness on the body. Just like we have similar verbs in English, like dishwashing. So you do dishwashing, but in Pali you need the object there, so you do dishwashing of dishes. You do, car driving of cars. You do aircraft pilots of aircraft. Aircraft pilots of aircraft. You always repeat these words, but there's nothing metaphysical, special in this, this way of speaking. Every language has their peculiarities. And what I always quote is the English term, it was raining cats and dogs. And that's never meant to think that your pets are falling from the sky. It just means it's raining heavily. And so if you don't know what the language is meaning, then sometimes you get these really weird translations. In this particular case, aware of the body, in the body, it never means that, it just means aware of the body. Having displayed the five hindrances, you abide aware of experience. They the man, energize and the purpose of what you are doing, the mindful, having restrained the five hindrances, aware of the mind, and then aware of the mind objects, energize and the purpose of what you're doing and mindful. And I put the having restrained the five hindrances first of all, because that's a prerequisite. You have to do that first of all. So waste the time trying to do Satipatthana when you have the hindrances which I was describing this morning. Otherwise, you don't see what's there, you see what you want to see. And you are not going to see what is you don't like seeing. And if you're sleepy, you hardly see anything. And if you're restless, you don't see things long enough to really understand them. And if you're down, you're just wondering what the heck you're doing rather than looking at what's happening. So those five hindrances have to be calmed down first of all before you even start Satipatthana. And so to go mindfulness of the body, you come up, square up this, and it whoops, mindfulness of breathing, you go to the wilderness, as I mentioned yesterday, not to the forest, or the rudimentary or to a schedule. Imagine Tibetan monks trying to practice that. There's no forest in Tibet, it's all mountains. So they will never be able to do mindfulness of breathing in Tibet if you have to go to a forest. It means the wilderness. Or to the rudimentary, secluded place, sit down, put your legs crossed, by second body of action, give priority to establishing mindfulness. Then mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. If we need breath out, if they're long, you're aware they're long. If they're short, you're aware they're short. Then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. Sometimes they say to train. Train is far too much effort, like in the military. You just learn this. And you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. Just as a skilled painter instead of a lathe operator, because you've probably never operated a lathe, but you, especially not one by using a treadle, but you certainly probably have painted something in your life. A skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when their in-breath is long, you're aware that it's long. In this way, you're aware of your own body, Beware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, and you try to wear the nature of both of another's bodies, or else you are blind and aware of what causes the arising of the body. And remember those are the four nutriments. You see them in a minute. Or you're blind and aware the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. Or you're blind contemplating the body's cause of nature of both arising and ceasing. Or mindfulness, that is just the body, impermanent suffering and not me, not mine, not a soul, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation. You abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world, especially not clinging to your body. You're free. The four postures, I said that is one way you're mindful of the body. You don't have to do every one of these. It's just you have alternatives. You're walking, you're aware in the present. I'm walking, standing, sitting or lying down. You're aware in the present, I'm lying down. Thus you maintain present moment awareness of however your body is disposed. Much better translation. It gives it more meaning. And the same, I repeated this same refrain, this way you're aware of your own body as with the other of the first mindfulness of breathing. Full comprehension of the purpose. You act in full comprehension of the purpose. That's what sampajanya means, for those of you who know a little bit of Pali. It means with wisdom, especially wisdom. Why do you think you're doing this? You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward, returning, when looking ahead, looking away, flexing, extending your limbs, wearing your clothes and carrying things. So it says, you know, in the suit of wearing your robes, it's the dress of the monks, but not many of you wear robes, and you don't just carry your arms well, you carry stuff. When carrying your things, you act in full comprehension of the purpose. You've got eating, drinking, defecating, urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. Supposed to be silent. What's the purpose of that? So when you are keeping silent, you're remembering the purpose. When you are talking, you're remembering why you're talking. Is this useful or is it just total waste of time disturbing others? In this way, you're aware of your own body, you're aware of the bodies of others. And I repeated all of these in each one because sometimes there is repetition, but every one of these needs to know that you have to, the purpose of these things is so you can know that your body, other body is the same. You view your body from head to toe, bound by skin, is made up of many kinds of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs, just as though you are a full shopping bag with many kinds of groceries, such as bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables. So too you find this same body full of many parts, thus in this body there are hairs, bones, shit and urine. And I insist on using the shit word, simply because that word is used by the majority of people, even though you may think it's rude, you use it, most people use it, so I have to use it, to bring this down to the language of ordinary human beings. Elements, you review your body by way of elements, thus, in this body there are the earth element, water element, I just went through this quickly because it doesn't really grab me. For the nine charm of growth, you see a corpse, wrote a sign in China, found after 3 days old, and then the different types of corpses. In this way, you are aware of your own body. So then you reflect that your own body is the same nature. Maybe you come like that and is not exempt from that fact. In this way, you aware of your own body or you aware of others' bodies. You aware of what causes the arising of the body. Abide aware the body's nature to cease when the four nutriments cease. Or else mindfulness is just the body, permanent suffering and not me, not mine, or a soul. Is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And your body independent, not clinging in the world. The most important thing is just the body with three characteristics, not me, not mine, not a soul, impermanent and essentially suffering. And then you have the benefits of psychic powers and stuff. So you can go through that. That's the kids I guess today. And the rising and passing away. Now this is, as well as the two Satipatthana suttas, there's also a whole section on associated discourses by the Buddha in the Satipatthana Samyutta. In the discourses grouped according to the subject about the Satipatthana Sutta. And there, if you read in those, that part of the scriptures, you find the Satipatthana Sutta elaborating especially when it comes to this thing, the arising and passing away of these things. Now, I know when I first came across the Satipatthana as a lay person, people said, you watch it rise and fall, rise and fall. You watch the pain come and pain go. You watch the breath come and go. That is not what it means. And it's in Satipatthana Samyutta, where it says, arising and passing away, what this means, the Buddha explains it. I will teach you the origination and the passing away of the four focuses of mindfulness. One, supported by the four nutriments, there is the origination and continuance of the body. With the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. The four nutriments are food, six sense, contact, that's the senses, will and consciousnesses. And I put consciousnesses in there, which you'll find all the way through this translation. That's far more accurate. And it also stops the idea that we have some essential underlying consciousness which is behind all things, which is another word for the self and the soul. Every one of the six consciousnesses is totally different, as maybe explained this one. And four, supported by the six sense contacts, is the origination of experience. Without sensing, you can't experience anything. And supported by another rupa, that's the objects of consciousness, is the origination of the mind, the jitta. With the cessation of the objects of consciousness, nama rupa, the jitta ceases. And I always pause there because as some people say the jitta is permanent, here it says specifically the jitta, the mind, like every other phenomena, is causally created and arises because of something, and when its cause is stopped, it too stops, ceases. Supported by attention, there is the origination of mind objects, and the cessation of attention, the mind objects ceases. And that's an important thing to know what it means by what some people call rising and falling. It means causes. When the cause is finished, so does the effect. This is core teachings of the Buddha. How are you mindful of experience? When you're feeling a pleasant experience, you're mindful you feel a pleasant experience. An unpleasant, you're mindful you feel an unpleasant experience. But feeling a neutral experience, instead of calling it neither pleasure nor painful, which is a big mouthful, a neutral experience, you are mindful you feel a neutral experience. But feeling a worldly pleasant experience, a worldly neutral experience, when feeling a worldly pleasant experience, a worldly unpleasant experience, or a worldly neutral experience, you are mindful you feel such a worldly pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. When feeling an unworldly pleasant experience, unworldly, unpleasant experience, or an unworldly neutral experience, you are mindful you feel such an unworldly, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. In this way, you're aware of your own experience, how you experience life, or you're aware that the experience of others is of the same nature as yours, or you're abide mindful of both your own and others' experience. Or you're also abide aware of what causes the arising of experience, the sensory contact. Or you're quite aware that experience of the nature to cease when sensory contact ceases. So you're not always going to experience things. When the senses stop, so does all experience. It's not always going to be there. Or else mindfulness, it is just experience. It's impermanent, that's why it's caused. Because it's caused, it can stop. It's suffering. And one reason for that is out of control. And it's not me, not mind or the soul. It's established in you. It's that necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you are independent, not clinging to anything in the world, in particular not clinging to your experience. It's experience, that's all. So the bad experience of the past, what many people get attached to, it's very weird. Unpleasant experiences, what we really attach to, the traumas, the bad experiences. People sometimes have post-traumatic stress. They cling to those experiences. You don't have to. It is not essential. It's common, but it's not natural. In the sense of, you do have an alternative. You don't need to cling to it. And if I need to pay nothing to anything in the world, that's how a meditator buys a mind full of experience. Then that's out of time. And we get the next one, mindfulness of the jitta. How are you mindful of the mind? Samadhi Mapra, mindful of the mind. You understand a mind that is affected by working as such, and a mind that is unaffected by working as such. Now this is an understanding, that's why we'll use the word hajanati here, that's from the text. It's not being aware that the mind is affected by working or not, it's understanding. Not just perception, it's the understanding of what this perception is telling you. A mind that is affected by wanting as such, and a mind unaffected by wanting as such. And now here again, the wanting is something we have to be aware of. Because, quite frankly, that's enemy number one to having a still and peaceful mind. Wanting something. And I'm sure if I haven't said that enough times already, I'll probably repeat it. Whenever you want anything, you are getting that need to move. And you lose stillness, you lose the happiness, you lose your energy. You don't want anything in meditation. I'm not talking about everyday life. I'm talking about when you sit down and you meditate, that can be the end of wanting for you for a while. Take a break. You understand a mind that is affected by aversion as such, a mind that is unaffected by aversion as such. You understand a mind that is affected by delusion as such, and a mind that is unaffected by delusion as such. You can understand these things. You may not be able to be totally aware of them, but in particular, maybe afterwards, you say that mind is delusion. You understand a contracted mind is contracted because of dullness and drowsiness. As I say, it's a very powerful metaphor there to feel that your mind gets very, very small when it's sleeping. And a distracted mind is distracted because of restlessness and remorse, which is all over the place. You understand an exalted mind as the past mind, the still mind, and the liberated mind, all referring to a mind in jhana as such, and an unexalted, unsurpassed, not still, not liberated mind that's not in jhana. And they make a point there of just the three they call kilesha, the three defilements of wanting, aversion, and delusion. And the opposite of that is the jhanas. It's what happens when you don't want things for long enough. When you have no aversion, you just let things be. And the delusion just lifts from you. And the result is the jhanas, sooner or later. It's not up to you. This is just cause and effect. In this way, you're aware of your own jitta, or you're aware that others' jittas are of the same nature as yours, or you're wide aware of both your own and others' jittas. I just use the word jitta instead of mind, because I think many people get to know that word if they hang around months and months long enough. Or else you're wide aware of what causes the arising of the jitta, which is nama-rupa, the objects. Or you're quite aware that jitta's an agent to cease when nama-rupa ceases. You're aware that the jitta is not permanent. Or you're quite contemplating the jitta's cause and nature, both the rising and ceasing. Or mindfulness is just the jitta. It's not me. It's not mine, not a soul. It's impermanent, it's suffering. Is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world, not even clinging to your own mind. In Buddhism, we are supposed to lose our mind. But not the way that most people do. This is how you're mindful of the mind. Mindful of the mind objects. You've got the five hindrances, first of all, and here I've just reordered them according to the earlier sutras. You're mindful of mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. When there was wanting regarding the five senses, you're mindful of such wanting. When there's no wanting regarding the five senses, you're mindful of no such wanting. You also understand how such wanting arises, how there comes such wanting, and how such wanting doesn't arise again. There being aversion in you, dullness and drowsiness in you, there being restlessness and remorse in you. When there was doubt in you, you are mindful of such doubt. Because when these hindrances are there, So it confuses, so it's very hard to be mindful of things which destroy mindfulness. Suppose, and you get the similes here, suppose you took out a loan, your business was successful, you paid that loan, there's enough left over for your own enjoyment, for that of your family, the loan you got for the joy. You suppose you're very ill, can eat or sleep, and no strength later, however, you recover, could eat or sleep again, you regain your strength as you start to be glad and full of joy. So the aversion is what is an illness, being anger is what is a sickness of the mind. And it means that sometimes people are so angry they can't sleep at night, they can't enjoy their food, which is irate. That's really crazy stuff. Or suppose you're in prison later, release, safe and secure, but not off to your property as anxiety would be. That is what I'm sure, that's dullness. Dullness is like being in a prison. You're not free. And one of the biggest dullnesses which come in here is depression. And asking anyone who's being depressed, it's like you're in a prison. You can't do anything, can't enjoy anything. No brightness in your life. But even more than that is the restlessness, thinking too much. You're a slave, depend upon others, unable to go where you want, because your mind is the control to go to this, go to that. The later you release from slavery, your mind becomes still, independent, able to go where you want, as a result you'll be glad and full of joy when the restlessness vanishes. So suppose you have to travel along a dangerous road across the wilderness, like the desert story I say today. But later you pass through that wilderness, safe and secure, no loss of your property, the result will be glad and full of joy. That's it now. In fact, you pass through it. When you don't know where you're going, which way, you don't know what's going to happen. And so too, when these five hindrances were present, you look back upon them as a debt, as wanting, a disease, aversion, whoops! And we minimize, please, yeah, like that. Okay, that's good. So, you look upon these five hindrances as a debt, disease, prison, slavery, and a dangerous road across the wilderness. But these five hindrances have been abandoned, regard that as freedom from debt. You don't want anything. Because you want things, you know, you use your credit card. You have lots of debt. I don't know about if you heard about that man for his wife's birthday, gave her plastic surgery. You know what plastic surgery means in our modern world? He cut up all her credit cards. Plastic surgery. And so freedom from debt, hell. You're not angry anymore at life. You're not angry at the past. You're not angry at yourself. It's like now you're mental health. And release from the prison. Oh, I'm now free. I'm not sleepy anymore. Freedom from slavery. Your mind is not dragging you around like they drag around a cow with a ring for its nose. And reaching a land of safety. Now you know what you're doing. No more doubt. So that was the first object of mindfulness, and I'll explain why I think that these are part of the fourth satipatthana in a few moments. I'll go through the next seven enlightenment factors. Or you're mindful of mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. These enlightenment factors are described as actually the process by which you become enlightened, and also what's the presence. Now, when you are enlightened, describes both the road and the destination. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you, you understand that it is present. This is mindful of being mindful, which is an interesting concept, but it's a very useful one. Are you mindful or not? Or are you just wandering away? If you can just stand back a little bit and be mindful that yes, I am mindful, I was mindful, that really helps. It's like a bit of a supervisor there, just checking up on what you're doing when you meditate. So, first of all, you are mindful, and the mindfulness is focused on the right areas. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you, you understand it is present. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is not what was not present in you, you understand that it was absent. You also understand how there comes to be the arising of the absent enlightenment factor of mindfulness. and how it comes to fulfillment by development, something which is not that often taught. How do you develop mindfulness? You may have an idea what it is, and then some people say, okay, now I know what it is, now I'm going to be mindful. And you will discover that you're not mindful just because you decide to be. Sometimes you can do that for a few seconds and then you wander off again. So how can you be mindful? It's a training like everything else. And that's why I spend a lot of time, first of all, just being mindful of your body. Just feel it. And what that does, you can't be aware of the feelings in the body, and how you're sitting with your legs in the right place or your back's in the right place, and be thinking, fantasizing at the same time. It's called substitution. Instead of just allowing the mind to wander off into dullness, onto restlessness, you really put your effort, your attention into feeling the body. It's important for you. That's why I like doing a scanning of the body under the pretext that you're going to have to sit for a long time, you better get it right to begin with, but it also serves the purpose of blocking out thinking. So, the next thing is, you know, to do present moment awareness, present moment, because that is where the mindfulness starts becoming established, in the present moment. But I think perhaps the best example of how to develop mindfulness is that old Emperor's Three Questions. Now the most important time, and very powerful teacher, which many people miss. Mindfulness is to be established first of all, not what you're mindful of, but mindfulness by itself. So whatever object is in front of your mind right now, is the most important object in the whole world. You give this moment and the contents of your consciousness in this moment real importance. Then you are aware. If you think that what I'm saying is really important, then you will listen. You will be mindful of what I speak. Too often, we don't give it the importance it deserves. Yeah, we're sort of half listening, half talking, but if you give it full importance to whatever's happening right now, mindfulness becomes established. And not just the awareness, but something again which is very rarely talked about, but I hope every one of you will experience for yourself the different intensities of mindfulness. And that comes around through stillness. The more stillness you have, the more powerful is the mindfulness. And this becomes crucial later on. If you want to really see deep into the nature of things, you know, get enlightenment insights, you have to be very, very powerfully aware. Not just the ordinary awareness of everyday life. And you'll know the difference because sometimes after you have a very deep meditation, as I say, first of all, you open your eyes and see the carpet. Wow, look at all the different colors in that carpet. It's like all fluorescent. The smells and the sounds. Someone already mentioned that in passing in one of the questions. That your body feels just so alive, it's like itchy or it's amplified. Sounds. All of these sounds are just incredibly loud. The thing is, you're really aware. But most of the time, you're dull. You got used to that darkness. And so it's like being sort of on some caffeine high or drug high. Just really aware, really awake. And that's actually where the mindfulness is incredibly strong. And when the mindfulness factor, enlightenment factor of mindfulness, comes to fulfillment by development, and you really are awake, then exploring the Dhamma is present in you. Now, sometimes people call that contemplating the Dhamma, and that means it's something you do. You explore it because it's right in front of you, it's your nature to do that, you can't resist it. And I like the word exploring. because that's going to places you've never been before. That's why, because wherever I go, people always pick me up in a car, and so I enjoy it if you get lost. Sometimes in Singapore, not so often in Singapore, you take a wrong turn because you're not being really aware of what you're doing, you're talking to me or something, and you take a wrong, you get lost. I really enjoy that, because when you get lost you find really interesting places in life. Don't always go on the well-worn routes of your daily schedule. Get lost. So that is where you explore. It's more than Dhamma. And with the enlightenment factor, when the enlightenment factor of energy is present in you, as you explore the Dhamma, life becomes much more interesting. You know, if you keep on routines, always do the same thing every day, every morning, if you always do the same thing, then you will find you get bored. You don't have any energy. So when you're really aware and you explore the Dhamma, it's really interesting. You get energized. And with energy, you also get the joy. Number four, the enlightenment factor of joy is present in you. It's an enlightenment factor. Joy. Enlightened people are not supposed to be miserable or angry or pains in the backside. They're supposed to be full of joy. And it's very easy for somebody to say wise stuff and to put down all these theories on the internet and claim that they're enlightened. But just what you say is not a good indication of whether you know what you're talking about or not. As you often know, I can talk about all sorts of subjects I don't know anything about, like marriage and your business and your kids. I've never been married. But it's the joy part of it. That's what you can't fake. So if anyone claims to be enlightened, check them out first of all. Not what they say, but how happy they are. That's an important enlightenment factor of joy. And an enlightenment factor of tranquility. Now each one of these, it's not said in this particular sutra, in other sutras, it says one of them leads to the next. When you're mindful, really mindful, then you explore. When you really explore, you get energy. When you're energized, you get joy. But when you have lots of joy, you get tranquility. And it's the two types of tranquility, the tranquility of the body and the tranquility of the mind. And this is said again and again, it's from this piti, this joy, that such tranquility comes. In other words, if you want to sit still for long periods of time, have a tranquil body, you need joy. If you join what you're doing, if you want to have a peaceful mind, joy, not willpower. If you heard this morning and you do this breath meditation, it becomes just so pleasant, you can stay with it for a long time. You have the tranquility of the body, the tranquility of the mind. If you enjoy yourself, you can't do this willpower. That is so unstable. Joy, you see it for hours now. So joy is based upon the joy, the tranquility, physical and mental tranquility. The quantum is not having any waves. And of course, as the tranquility deepens, you get the stillness. This word here is samadhi. It does not mean concentration. If you think it means concentration, you'll really miss the place of meditation and enlightenment. Stillness. And that word in English has a powerful meaning for me anyway. Just everything becomes still, nothing moves. Wisdom born of stillness. Things vanishing when they're still. And from the stillness, it's not mentioned here, that's where you get wisdom. From stillness, you see things as they truly are. It's not here, but it's elsewhere. and then become equanimous. Equanimity means you just look upon stuff without reacting. And you understand that these factors are present in you. And you understand that these factors are not present in you. And you also understand how these things come about. So those were the first two, and basically the only two, of the fourth focus of mindfulness. So the first three were to see that these are areas which you attach to, you take to be your essential self, or that your most essential possessions. You own your body, and you're scared when it gets threatened with dangers such as sickness. So we do the first Ajahnapatthana so we don't get attached to our body, we can let it go. It's time to go, it's just done. No big deal. This is not mine. I'm only visiting my body for 60, 70 years. I'm not alone, I'm a visitor. I have to let it go. It's a cracked grass, I know that. I care for it, but when it cracks, I expected that. And we don't, not so much think experience is ourself, but we think we own experience, we can control our experience. We think if we're wise enough and learn enough, then we can only have pleasant experience, and all the unpleasant experience is only because we're stupid. We don't know enough and make stupid decisions. And if we were wise, we could control our experience only to have happy experience. And you'll find that it's totally impossible, and this Ajahnapatthana tells you so. It's just experience. It's out of control because you don't own it. It's not yours. You're not the driver. Karma, nature is the driver, not you. So, you better suck up to the unpleasant experience of life. Everyone gets it. You can't sort of avoid it. If you come here to get rid of all of your suffering, you're going to have suffering, you're going to have happiness. What we're here for is to realize that it doesn't belong to us. It is Nanya. Remember the word Nanya this morning? Nanya business. And in its, in its place, the hindrances, we have this. So that's the body. Experiences is out of control. The mind, because so many people assume or they get into the delusion that their mind is their essential self. When you start to see these things vanishing and disappearing, well, this can't be mine. And the last part is the objects of the mind, because these are what you're supposed to be mindful of, because the hindrances are what stop you being enlightened. So you've got a lot of awareness in these things as the cause for the delusion of stupidity and stopping you being still. That's why you're aware of them. And you've got a lot of time aware of their opposites. You know, are these enlightenment factors in there? And those enlightenment factors are the opposite of the hindrances. The hindrances are the problem, enlightenment factors are the solution. Clear as that. And that was the original Satipatthana. The other ones came in here, they're really good dharmas to be aware of and understand, but it wasn't in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is why sometimes you get confused why this thing is in there. But nevertheless, here we come. The five components of existence, these are the khandhas. And I call them components of existence. I think that's a really neat translation, because these, you put these things together and you get existence as we know it. Or you are mindful of mind objects in terms of the five components of existence. You are mindful, such is form. It's not just the body, it's the pillows, it's the earth, it's the water, it's the stars, it's the black holes, it's also space. It's also time. Such is form, such is origin, such is disappearance. Such is experience, the Vedana, such is origin, such is disappearance. Such is perception, such is origin, such is disappearance, such is will. This is a major part of the four of the khandhas, components of existence. It has other parts to it, but the major portion of the fourth khandha is will. That is said by the Buddha. I wanted to call will and other stuff, but Ajahn Bhavani just kept arguing with me, and I conceded the major part of the fourth khandha is will, and put that down first and center, and then you understand what these khandhas are. Will. Such is origin, such is disappearance. Such are the consciousnesses, the six consciousnesses, such are origin, such are disappearance. Will is not yours. It doesn't belong to you. It's a khandha. It comes and goes according to conditions. You don't control it. So you understand the five components of existence. The six dead spaces. We are mindful of mind objects in terms of the six internal and external sense spaces. You understand sight, understand forms, understand the effect of watching that arises independent on both. When you have a sense and you see the object of the senses, the effect of what binds you together is either the joy, the happiness, or sometimes the negativity towards that. That also binds you to the object. It means it's your business to be that. You can't just let it be, say it's none yet. It becomes your business and then you are fettered, tied to it. Do you understand how there comes to be the rising of after the abandonment of the fetter, and how there comes to be the future not arising of the abandoned fetter and some of the other five sense spaces? Or the Four Noble Truths, the mindful of mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths. We understand what suffering is, where it comes from, where it ends, and the way leading to its ending. So summary of the mind objects, in these ways you are aware of mind objects, you're aware that others' mind objects are of the same nature as yours, or you're mind aware of both your own and others' mind objects. Or you're mind aware of what causes the arising of mind objects, because you give attention to them. If you take the attention away, they vanish. Your mind aware that mind objects are nature succeeds, and attention ceases, or your mind contemplating your mind objects cause the nature, both arising and ceasing. It's not what you experience is the truth. What you experience, what you pay attention to, that comes and goes. Like I've told many people, if you have a bad relationship with somebody, it's because you're paying attention to their negative qualities. You're paying attention to the two bad bricks. But some people say, oh, but my partner's 998 bad bits, 998 trillion bad bits. Yes, but there's always a few good bits there as well. If you keep paying attention to the bad qualities, that mind object grows. If you take attention away from bad objects and put them on good objects, the good objects grow. Mind objects are caused by your attention. It's just mind objects, that's all, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a soul, whatever you think, it's not important. It's a mind object, that's all. Establishing it is then necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essentially to be liberated from all your mind objects. Liberated from all your thoughts and perceptions, don't trust any of it. Woohoo! And you find independent about clinging to anything in the world. This is how you're mindful of mind objects. That's the Satipatthana. Sabri Satipatthana. So, with reference to this, to state the four purposes of mindfulness, leading one direction only, the purification of beings, to go beyond sadness and crying. What are you sad and crying for? It's none yet. The disappearance of physical and mental suffering, that's not me, so what am I talking about that for? The attempt of the true way to the realization of nirvana. Now, Nirvana through Anapanasati. Now, I mention this is because a lot of time people associate the Satipatthana with Vipassana. Vipassana equals Satipatthana. And the truth of the matter is, it's total opposite. Satipatthana is associated with samatha, with mindfulness of breathing. And that's in the word of the Buddha. Dipanapanasati, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is a great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. So if you do anapanasati, you are practicing satipatthana. Anapanasati is satipatthana practice. So it's when some people say, well, we should do mindfulness of breathing first, and then we switch to satipatthana. That is Gavaya. Look at what the Buddha said. That's in the corner there, let's say MN118, the Anapanasati Sutta, Vaisakha Nikaya. When mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati, is developed and cultivated, it completes, fulfills the four focuses of mindfulness. And when the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and diligence, which is a synonym for enlightenment. How does this work? And we go through the first four steps. In breath and out breath are long, you wear they are long. When they are short, you know they are short. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you're watching the breath, you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances. Be able to watch the breath that much, your hindrances are pretty restrained. They're not absent, but most of them are just, they're so weakened, it's only just a shadow of what they usually are. To be able to do that much, you have to really restrain those hindrances. Energized, fully aware of the purpose, why are you watching this breath? And mindful, in and out breathing. This is said by the Buddha, it's regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category of bodies. He says, I often quote this, when people say the third of those stages of Anapanasati, you're aware of the whole body of breath. So this is what the Buddha said, the whole body, is the breathing. In and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body. In the category of bodies, it belongs to this holy term Kaya, the first of the five khandhas. That is why on that occasion, when you're watching the breath, abide mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. That fulfills the first satipatthana, focus of mindfulness. You don't have to just always go watch the autopsies or the funerals. Doing the breath is sufficient. When you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience the mental formation of Piti Sukha together as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm this mental formation of Piti Sukha as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of experience. Having restrained the five hindrances, they have been really weak to be able to do this. Energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, for being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. Interesting point here, in those four stages of Anapanasati, stages 5 to 8, you are not so aware of the breath, you're aware of the vein and the feeling, the pleasure of the breath. It's changed from being a focus on something bodily to the experience of it, the pleasure of it, the joy of it. And how do you do this? You learn to experience the joy. So often when people don't focus on the joy or the pleasure of meditation, they think it should be painful, no pain, no gain, they're so stupid. Again, that comes from amazing the religions, many religions in our world, they praise asceticism. The more austere you are, the more holy you are. One of the reasons when the Buddha decided to give up austerities before his enlightenment his first five disciples gave up on him. They thought, no, you're slacking. You'll never get enlightened that way. Austerity, asceticism is the only way. And that's why you still find these days the crazy people in the Philippines on Easter, they volunteer to get themselves nailed to the cross. And they flog themselves, thinking that somehow that's going to help. There's enough suffering in this world without getting into that business. So, but people feel that if it's no pain, no gain. And somebody once told me about the Protestant idea. Another Protestant, the Puritans, the people who first colonized the United States. And they said that Puritan is defined as the fear that somewhere someone is having a good time. And for some, that's religious for some people. I remember that from my youth. Going to church was not a very fun place to be. It's cold, no heaters. You weren't supposed to have heaters, you're supposed to suffer. No cushions. Didn't say anything. And the sermons were no jokes. Never heard a joke, not once, going to church. Well, I had it after that. Just told how much of a sinner I was and how I was going to go and burn in hell. And I thought, well, at least it's better than freezing in church. But anyway, that was just my opinion. It has changed since, I shouldn't really. But that's not to all Christians. So anyway, so this is going to experience the joy and the pleasure if you've been in and out. And this is a mental formation. It's not with the breath. The breath is just the breath. When they say the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, no, it's in the mind of the knower. When your mind is positive and also very still, it builds up energy. The joy is actually made by the mind, being pretty still. And then you have incredible happiness. Whatever you look at is happy. I've told you this story before, I'm not going to say it again. It's this really great story. The time when I was really nice meditation, went to the toilet in Jarnagrove, looked in the toilet bowl, and I really threw my mind on that piece of shit in the toilet bowl. It really absolutely beautiful. Now that's true. I was telling that, another person said he did the same, or she did it, and it was true. We couldn't believe just what comes out of the backside to be so beautiful. And of course you all know that that beauty, that cannot be, you know, in the actual the contents of the toilet bowl, which is what the mind made of it. It is a mental formation. Is what I added. With my mind, which is so peaceful, so powerful, up to what is usually very disgusting. So it's amazing what you can do. What's disgusting is not our hearts are turned into something incredibly beautiful. Thousands of it. And anyway, experience a mental formation of Pitta Sukha and calm it. Sometimes it can be very exciting. It calms down by itself. If you try to calm it down, it gets worse. Just let it be, always making peace, being kind, being gentle. This story has really suffered. Now, on these occasions, where is the breath? You're still breathing in and out, but you're focusing on the experience, especially that part of the experience which is very pleasurable. And it says here, for being mindful of the pleasure associated with this state of breath meditation, is being mindful of experience. That is why meditation and meditation provides mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindful. Are you really energized now? Your energy is going up. Really full of awe. Now, the third Satipatthana, which is coincides here with the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stages of the Anapanasati. When you learn to experience the jitter, the nimitta, as you breathe in and out. And the nimitta is the usual light in the mind. What is that? Why do you see a light? Five senses have been really squashed. They're hardly there at all. You can hardly feel your body. To hear a sound that's like a million miles away, that's so common, the limiter comes up. Sometimes you can be aware of your body if your mind is really strong. The mind is so strong it dominates it, and other five senses haven't totally been turned off. But that is what this limiter is. It's how you experience your own jitta, your mind, sixth sense. When you learn to experience the jitta as you breathe in and out, this is the limiters come up after the joy stage. When you learn to brighten the limiter can be quite dull at first, but just leave it alone. Without a positive mind state, don't do anything. Kindness really helps. The limiter is incredibly bright. And you learn how this works. And also, when you learn, scroll a bit more, you learn to settle the limiter. It's that stilling. It's a samadhi, samadhan, the limiter. Or samadhan, chitam. As you breathe in and out, that's you have to keep it calm, peaceful. That is an interesting task to do. Because you've got so much energy, so much bliss, it just moves around all over the place. And I'll tell you the trick, because you know what I learned, is that if the only reason why the limiter moves is because you, the one watching, is moving. It's a reflection of your mind. So you be still. Stop moving around. Your limiter will be still. And the last one, the 12th, when you learn to enter the jhana, the liberation of the jitta. And that is again so common elsewhere in the sutras. That stage means the experience of jhanas. You have to settle them to make it really bright, and from there you enter, go right inside. Similarly, of the lotus, you go right inside, and the jitta is totally liberated from the body and the five senses. In the jhanas, you cannot be a stuff. You cannot feel your body. That's the five senses are now totally disappeared. And by the way, you can't think, that's really gross. And because on those occasions you are mindful of the jitta, you really know the jitta now, clear. Restrain the five hindrances actually here, especially after that the 12th stage, enter the jhana, the hindrances are gone. They're not just restrained, they've disappeared for a while. And energized, now you're truly energized. If you have a dharma this afternoon, you won't be able to sleep tonight. You don't want to sleep tonight, you don't need to sleep tonight. You've been boosted with huge amounts of energy. It happened. You just lay down and just mindfully just rest your body. And, there we go, you're energized. Fully aware, ooh, now you're really aware and mindful, and you do not say that there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dumb, who is not fully aware, reaching a jhana with the hindrances gone. The hindrances are what stops mindfulness. Even when the hindrances have been lessened, but they're still there, you're not really mindful. If you've been in a jhana, and you come out, now you know what mindfulness is. Real, strong, powerful, real thing. And that's where you get enlightened afterwards. Mindfulness is, ooh, really strong. And, where's it going? That is why on that occasion, meditator wise, mindful of the mind, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindfulness. So, there is really completed. The third seventh of time, just by doing Anapanasana. And the last part, mind objects. In particular, the mind objects which make you enlightened. When you learn to explore impermanence in breath meditation, you learn to explore things fading away in breath meditation. Impermanence doesn't mean coming and going. You know the causes, why they come, why they go. You know, things fading away, but everything starts disappearing. When you learn to explore things ceasing in breath meditation, things which have always been there are no longer there. You learn to explore relinquishing things in breath meditation, getting lost, letting things go. On these occasions, you are mindful of the mind objects, the Dhamma, especially the Dhamma trees of life. That was three of the five hindrances, which is energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindfulness. That you see with wisdom the impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment of the five hindrances. Fading away, ceasing, and relinquishment of your hindrances. Now they're gone. You are mindful with equanimity. That is why on that occasion you are mindful of mind objects and refrain the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindfulness. That is how mindfulness of breathing, developed and cultivated, completes the four processes of mindfulness. And out of the four functions of mindfulness developed and cultivated, complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the mind of the body has explained the five hindrances, energized, on that occasion, steady mindfulness is established in you. On whatever occasion, steady mindfulness is established in you, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused. You develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment. And this is where it says, of course, from one enlightenment factor to the other. When you are not mindful, you respond to another with wisdom. On whatever occasion the mind must mind you explore the Dhamma with wisdom, on that occasion the exploration of the Dhamma life and practice allowed in you. And in developing mind development, it comes to fulfillment in you. The word said about the third time I've mentioned this. This is how you explore the Dhamma. Not by thinking, giving it a name, by going beyond the names. Mindful, not enough to penetrate it. When you explore the Dhamma with wisdom and embark upon a full inquiry into it, unflagging energy is aroused, it really becomes interesting. And in that interest, the joy actually starts to arouse the energy. Whatever occasion, unflagging energy, unflagging is not the best word, it means it doesn't weaken, it gets stronger and stronger. Many start times when you exert energy, it tires you out. Here, it never tires you out, it just gives you more energy as you really get into it. Whatever occasion, unflagging energy is aroused as you explore God with wisdom. On that occasion, the energy and life effect is aroused in you. Developing by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. And when you have aroused energy, unworldly joy arises. You're really having fun. On whatever occasion, unworldly joy arises. On that occasion, the joy life factor is devised in you. I go through quite quickly because I'm running out of time. When you experience unworldly joy, your body and mind become tranquil. You're having fun. But the body doesn't want to move. But the mind becomes really still. The tranquility and life factor is developed in you. When your body is tranquil, you feel pleasure in the mind. This is important. It says it here. It didn't say there were seven enlightenment factors in the fourth Satipatthana, but it's often mentioned. When your body is tranquil, your mind feels pleasure. When you go to the spa and your body feels really at ease, your mind is pleased as well. It's pleasurable. When the mind becomes still, when you feel pleasure in the mind becomes still. Sukhino jitam samadhi yati, one of my favorite phrases, from happiness you become still. Not through pain, not through suffering. Through happiness you become still. Whatever occasion the mind becomes still and joyful, on that occasion the stillness, enlightenment factor, that's the mind, is aroused in you. You develop it, mind development, it comes to fulfillment in you. And you observe such a still mind with equanimity. Whatever occasion you observe with equanimity, the still mind, on that occasion the equanimity, enlightenment factor, is aroused in you. Develop it, mind development, it comes to fulfillment. That is how the four focuses of mindfulness, development, cultivating, completing seven enlightenment factors. And here you develop the mindfulness and enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, moving away from stuff, physical and mental. That's why we go to a place like this for a retreat. It's comfortable, but it's out of the way of stuff, hopefully. Fading away, cessation of life is in relinquishment. Develop the exploration of Dhamma, the energy, joy, tranquility, stillness, equanimity, enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, fading away, cessation. That is how the seven enlightenment factors develop and cultivate complete full enlightenment. So said the Buddha. So, oh, I've got an informative class part. So, because that's very important teachings, and I did repeat what I did yesterday because it was the old translation, I hope you can appreciate the power of a good translation. You don't have the right meaning of the words, too much repetition, sometimes you miss what the Buddha's trying to say. So, before we finish off to have a cup of tea, or maybe if you have any questions about that, then you can put them in the box and I'll answer them this evening. Remember, this evening we start with question and answer at 7 o'clock. Maybe I'll do the question and answer at 7 o'clock, and when the question and answer is finished, then do the meditation in the end rather than the other way around. So those of you who want to meditate later on in the night, you can still meditate until 10 or 11 or whatever. Question and answer first. So, any questions in the box there, so you can share with everybody. But, I don't know if it is a question. Anyone got any questions to ask just right now? You can put your hand up and say anything which I said you want to elaborate. Yeah? Piti and Sukha. It's very hard to understand exactly what those words are, but it's always joy, happiness, good feeling, pleasure, bliss, ecstasy, depending on how powerful they happen to be. The difference is unimportant. The only way you know what that difference is when you experience what we call the third jhana. Because until that time, whenever there's pity, there's always sukha. Whenever there's sukha, there's always pity. They always go together. And that's why sometimes people try and find different names for them. And it just doesn't really help at all. It's called happiness and joy, but it gets really, really extreme. The coarser part of it is the pity. The more refined part is the sukha. It's, I don't know, I haven't got enough. Even though I was English born and well educated, I can't really get the words better to say about this. It's just the sukha is more refined than the pity. It's really bliss, it's ecstasy. But ecstasy at different levels. And when you get into these jhanas, I mean, you know what ecstasy is. One of the anecdotes, you've already heard me say that, you know, these pity sukha, the joy and happiness you get in the jhana, is better than sexual orgasm. But I never realized just how powerful it is when this heroin addict who was staying at my monastery tried his very, very best to get off the habit. And he feels so much compassion for people who take that first needle of heroin. Apparently, I'm no expert in this, but sometimes it doesn't do anything for people. But for some people, just one injection, and that's caught you for life. It's one of the worst addictions. And that's what he did. He thought, one needle, just try it out, never know, it will stop, you can't. And he was one of these heroin addicts, and had a beautiful wife, he was so supportive. Wanted to come stay at a monastery where he would be free. And so I was really struggling, but doing really, really well. And I remember him telling me, he said, every day, 1,000 times he has to say no. Every day to say no. But after a month or so, one time he said yes. He was addicted. So it's just a really hard thing to do. And he really, every time that he, one yes, and it's back again. Thousands and thousands of nights. The reason I mention this to him, because he came up to me one day and was so excited, and he said, yeah, I've heard you say that many, many times before, that the bliss of deep meditation is better than sex. But he said, it's better than heroin. And heroin is much, much, much better than sex. So he said. So, I don't know heroin. But, he was being honest, no reason for him to exaggerate. It was really, really deep joy and happiness. This pity sukha you get. That's what I want to share with you. Why wouldn't you? I'm a dealer. The child of this dealer. And you don't get addicted to get away. Yeah. Okay, the status of job, that's coming tomorrow. The light says stillness. So I'll leave that until tomorrow. Okay, I think that's probably enough. I can have a cup of tea now. And anything to do with the job is what happens after we do this satipatthana. That's coming tomorrow. You can see it's actually a pond there, white stillness. Coming tomorrow. Excellent. Okay, thank you, Jesus.
Sadhu.
Just by the way, if anyone thinks I'm not traditional by doing the three extreme sadhus,
there was one famous monk in Thailand who passed away in the aircraft accident many years ago. It was Ajahn Sinpong. He was a very close disciple of Ajahn Mahabhua, one of the great forest monks. And when he gave, I first went to visit him in his monastery, that was 37 years ago, he gave the traditional blessing. Now, I will give and give you that blessing, you know, when blessing a baby or for good health or your business. But when he gave the blessing, this is how he did it. I remember, so I'll never forget it. It's one of the reasons I do these three extreme sadhus, following his tradition. He would start with, Yatha Vayuaha Pura Kari Purenti Sagaran Eva Mevani Kodinam And when I first heard it, you know, I didn't know what to do. Should I laugh or should I be serious? You know, this was a very holy monk, very famous, fortunate. And I learned from him. He was so loved by all the villagers and everybody. And he just had this wonderful character. And just, if you're going to give a blessing, just make it fun, make it interesting. Why should religion be so serious? And you can see just how that works so well. That was Ajahn Sinpong. Did you ever meet him? Ajahn Sinpong, somebody? Oh, just he was so alive. So if you give a blessing, give everything you've got. So the three sadhus are traditional. I learned that from one of the great forest masters, Ajahn Sinpong. Thank you.